Hi, this is Paul. What made Jordan Peterson's biblical series special? It's not an easy question to answer. It was special. I know that there are some people who think it wasn't, but that a university professor of psychology could rent out a theater and fill it. Now, some people will say, oh, that's just because at that point he had gotten famous because of C-16. No, but he was rambling on for 2+ hours about the Bible. And those videos have gotten millions of views. And Jordan Peterson's pathway is different from that of Brett Weinstein or Sam Harris or Peter Boghossian or any of these other people who were sort of pushed around by that IDW moment. And part of what made Jordan different was the biblical series. And so I want to spend a little bit of time talking about that as we begin to get into Exodus. The great Anglican evangelical preacher John Stott wrote a book on preaching, and the title of that book is Between Two Worlds. And I think that title really nails what preaching is about. On one hand, you have to connect the biblical world to the audience. That's what preachers do. Now, I think the truth is that there are many more preachers today than those of us who have that title and name and speak in churches. In fact, our culture has proliferated the number of preachers, and they've got all kinds of different other names. They're teachers, they're influencers, they're celebrities, they're gurus, they're all over the place. And the situation is not that somehow we are devoid of religion, but we are simply awash in it. But so much of that, because of what happened in modernity with the definition of religion, so much of that is now below the surface, and we're not processing it cognitively. Now, on the video that I released this morning, Jordan Peterson's Exodus series, episodes 1 and 2 are available on Daily Wire Plus. Senior Saboya, I thought, left a tremendous comment. Senior Saboya wrote this: I haven't watched the new series, but I plan to do so by this weekend. What you said about the Jews reading Torah via a legal path and normies reading the Bible via a cultural hodgepodge rings true for me. I was just talking with my mother over the holiday about her connection to the church, the faith, and the Bible. Naturally, I've heard some of what she has said my whole life. But it had never struck me how the structure of her faith is also sedimentary. Now, that's sedimentary, not sedentary. Sedimentary meaning that as she went along, all of those mappings from when she was a child on up sort of created for her what I call collective biblical relevance realization. It's sort of the pathway by which the Bible comes to her. Now, this is different from hermeneutics. Hermeneutics are sort of rules of interpretation. What I'm talking about is much more unconscious, much more implied, much more basic to a culture's ability to appropriate the Bible and take it in and integrate it with life. So I'll read that sentence again. Naturally, I've heard some of what she said my whole life, but it had never struck me how the structure of her faith is almost sedimentary. Layer after layer of affirming deposits have been laid over her lifetime. Having never made a concerted study of these matters, she seemed to have developed and maintained a set of ideas over her life that somehow opened spiritual doors for her. It's idiosyncratic and very personal. It's what has proven to work for her. And I think what Senior Saboya has basically showed us is given us a vision into how this works for many of us. Now, some of us do, in fact, sort of get into the sedimentation with our hands and add new things and employ a degree of intentionality about managing it. But if you've ever tried to really work, let's say, the sand on a beach, you notice that it's really a lot of work. I mean, you can dig a hole, but the ocean comes in. We are recipients of an enormous number of things that we are seldom terribly cognizant of or visual too. Now, a big part of this channel has always been me both trying to understand that which is implicit beneath the surface and to maybe make it more explicit and visible so that we understand it. Now, a good amount of this occurred to me while I was watching this video from Chris Williamson about how men compete for status with Rob Henderson. I followed Rob Henderson on Twitter for quite a while. He had a terrific conversation with Jordan Peterson. If I recall, that was an earlier conversation, and did Peterson interrupt him too much? It could very well be. But he had a wonderful conversation with Chris Williamson, and I want to play some of that for you.
There was one study. They showed a series of women videos of men, and then at the end they asked these women, how sexually attractive is this man? Then they showed a group of men the same videos of these same guys and asked them, how likely is it that this man would win a physical fight with another man? Then the researchers tracked those men in those videos and had them return 18 months later and asked them a bunch of questions, including, how many sexual partners have you had over the last 18 months? The correlation between how sexually attractive the women found these men and how many partners they had was zero, but there was a strong and significant correlation between how intimidating or formidable men rated them and how many sexual partners they recounted over the last 18 months. And so essentially, how tough a guy looks to men is a stronger predictor of his sexual success than how attractive he looks to women.
Now, that's a very interesting teaser for the conversation. It was a very interesting conversation. What it shows, now, there's a lot, I've been thinking a lot about this evolutionary psychology approach to, that is so popular right now in sort of the YouTube red-pilled mythosphere. But part of what's interesting about these dynamics that they're finding is that these aren't just simply individual. Evolutionary psychology sort of began with the imaginary that we're kind of individuals all by ourselves. And I've made the point recently, as Jordan Peterson has been making quite regularly on his conversations, that sanity isn't something that's sort of in our head between our ears, but it's something that's between us and among us. It's very much community-based. Now what a number of these observations show is that there's a whole lot of things that are sort of kept in the cloud, as it were, between us. So they asked women, okay, which of these men are more sexually attractive? But actually, women, as Jordan Peterson has said many times, sort of peel off the top of the status hierarchy. And it's the men, to a certain degree, who are deciding who all the women are going to pay attention to. Now let's pick up this conversation a little bit later.
So funny. what does it mean to say that masculine traits amongst men seem, and secondary sex characteristics seem, to be more about formidability than attraction? They are antlers rather than peacock's tails, because it seems like men judging other men's formidability is more accurate at estimating the number of sexual partners that a man has, so how successful he is with women, than his attractiveness is. How, given the fact that women say they're not attracted to it, and yet the men that have these things are the ones that are the most successful, does that not just mean that women don't know what they're attracted to? Revealed versus stated preference.
And again, what do we know, and at what level do we know? Now, they might not be cognizant of it. They might not be meta-conscious of it, but it is obviously impacting behavior. And we see this all the time. There's all these layers beneath us that are impacting our behavior that we're unaware of, and sometimes we become conscious of it. Gosh, we need more words in that space, because we need more words in that space.
Preferences.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I'm inclined to say that, like, I think they would acknowledge that those things are, like, more attractive than the average, or maybe not having those things But they would state, you know, this other kind of preference of like, yeah, I want a guy who's muscular, but not too muscular or something like that. But yeah, there is this, I mean, for human behavior in general, right, there's often this mismatch between what people say and what people do. And yeah, stated versus revealed preference. And I think there is there's something like that going on here, too, where like for men, what is like the, you know, more so than for women, a strong predictor of your sexual success, your romantic success, is your status, right? And status is this sort of amorphous, you can't look at status under a microscope or something, right? It's something that exists in the minds of other people, and people have to agree that you have it, right? Like, you don't get to decide if you have it, other people do. And in this instance, throughout evolutionary history, it seems that men have been the ones to confer status on other men more so than women. And I know that Jordan Peterson's made this point too about like how, you know, there are sort of these dominance or competence hierarchies, and women sort of use those, you know, they sort of use this as a sort of cognitively outsource this burdensome task of picking an attractive partner.
They just fill the guys off the top of the hierarchy.
Exactly. And they don't, like, oftentimes women don't even know or care what the contest is, right? I make this point in that article about how, like, women, a lot of women don't even, they don't like sports or they don't watch sports, but they still find athletes attractive, right? Dude, they're like, I don't know what you're doing out in that field, but I love athletes,
you know? How fucking good, would it be to create, right? And you have this huge pool of men, 100 men over time, and it's like a round robin type scenario, and then it's knockout stages all the way to the top, and then get the women to rate the attractiveness of the men over time. And maybe run that a bunch of different times and run different women through and see if the guys that won a competition, which was completely based in luck, are the ones that are given more attractiveness. And if you can have someone, you could have to control it somehow where you had attractiveness before and attractiveness after. How much does winning a completely arbitrary game improve your attractiveness to women?
It's a good question. I think that, so if you were to carry out that experiment, you would need to have...
He talked about a coin flip. It just didn't want to waste the time of him setting it up.
You need to introduce an additional element, which would be other men respecting the winner. I think that's a key component here. It's like, it's not just winning the contest. Yes. It's winning a contest that matters to men in particular, right? Like if you win the coin tossing contest or whatever, and you have a bunch of other guys being like, oh, that was incredible, man, that was awesome, you know, high fives.
You need to observe them being competitive, pedestalizing the person that won.
I think that is the that would actually be the key here for women, sort of the variability of their attractiveness ratings would shift somewhat based on that. And I think, like, basically, like, there's just like interesting papers on this about like how, you know, so the sports competition is one where maybe women aren't particularly interested in sports, but yet they find athletes attractive. Historically, you know, a lot of women, even educated women, were illiterate, and yet they still found well-known authors to be attractive. You know, like they find painters and artists attractive, you know, even if they may not necessarily understand what's going on with the art, but they see that the respect and prestige that the artist accrues from the art community or from the sort of the class of people that they're around, those kinds of things. And so, I mean, you can see this with, I mean, to me, one of the more amusing examples of this is like guys who play video games on YouTube get groupies, you know, like you're just like this guy like playing games and like uploading a live stream and commenting on it. And they have a million subscribers or whatever.
And even if their girlfriends hate them playing video games as much as they do.
And I've seen like news coverage and media articles about like, yeah, he's a 19-year-old kid who plays video games all day, and he's getting love letters and, you know, girls messaging him on Instagram and all this stuff. And it's like, if he was just a dude sitting at home playing video games, he wouldn't get a single love letter, right? But the fact that he has a million other nerds out there like saying like, oh, I love you, man, you're
pre-selected,
my
this like, is the king of our group. Well, yeah, it's so funny because
the king of the gamers.
Yeah, the same accusation that's thrown at men as them retreating from society and not being a viable mate for women, video games in the basement, spending too much time on screens, if you just tune that up to high performance and everybody else says, yeah, I know that he's doing the thing that people say is the antithesis of being attractive to women, but he's the best at it. You go, oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now he's super attractive.
Yeah. There's, I think
this is fascinating. But look at the deep level at which these things are functioning. And again, it's not happening. What matters to the women is what's in the collective consciousness of the men. Notice what that says about us. Okay, so the main point there is that there's a lot going on underneath the surface that we are not aware of. And all of that going on underneath the surface is not just sort of inside our own heads as individuals, but we are constantly doing that between us, which gets into this question of plausibility structures. Leslie Newbegin, who was an Anglican, I think it was Anglican, y'all in the comment section will correct me if I'm wrong. He went to India and spent a career in India as a missionary during a good part of the 20th century, came back to England and found the whole place different. And so he began writing these very insightful books, which I think are foundational reading for anyone who wants to do evangelistic work in the contemporary West. And he talked a lot about plausibility structures. And one of the things that recently on this amazing conversation between Grim Grizz and Chad the Alcoholic, where they began talking about plausibility structures. Anselman, I just did an interview with the guy who had talked to Jonathan Peugeot's brother, Matthew, and we had a wonderful talk. But he asked me what I thought this little court on the internet was about. And Grim Grizz and I are on the same page. This is about us thinking together and us trying to think better as we're thinking together and to sort of create a structure by which we in fact do this together. Churches are, of course, these plausibility structures. And as I mentioned to Dan, that's who did the interview, we never believe alone. We're always outsourcing our relevance realization to each other, and we're doing this communally and togetherly. We're doing this communally and together, but plausibility is a huge part of it, and there's a lot that goes into this, and I thought Grim really nailed it in this little clip.
That's not how you spell Janice, Anselman. Anselman gave me one hell of a video.
And I'm still trying to find out what video that was, Anselman, so put it down below because I want to watch it. Maybe you gave it to me already. But again, just because it impacted Grim Grizz and won't impact me the same, that's quite likely true.
There's this thing. Okay, so there's this thing called Christian apologetics. And despite what you would think, they're not apologizing for being Christian, or apologizing for what the church has done over the centuries, or apologizing for Jesus. They're paying homage to the Greek word apologia, and it means reason or something. And I only bring that up to say to you,
I just have to say that it is with a degree of delight that I had Chris Williamson and Rob Henderson, and now I've got Grim Grizz and Chad the Alcoholic. This is what it means to think together.
The video this Anselman provided me with was what I would call Christian unapologetics. At least the first set that I haven't seen coming wearing Orthodox robes. So, and
the first set he didn't see wearing Orthodox. So just pause and think that through. So much of what Grimm said is just layer after layer after layer. If you just slow it down and think, the whole Orthobros movement is all about what Grim Grizz is calling Christian unapologetics. And this gets very much into my steep slope, gentle slope, and very much into the culture war series that I just started with Jordan Peterson, but Tim Keller. But there's only so much time to make videos every day.
And it was he's my kind of guy, because he'll like, he, you know, like, I don't know, people get wrapped up in these LARPs, and they're real because people get wrapped up in these LARPs, but like the basis somebody invests in it can be misleading. They could have been misled, they have a wrong perspective on what's going on in the circumstance, and actually be supporting something they're not. They don't. They wouldn't if they knew what was really up. And then there's this one piece of information that kind of diffuses it all. Like the FDA, for example. I found out that people, they were trying to get aspartame, the stuff they put in diet sodas, approved like 17 times. And the FDA was like, nope, 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 that's poison, nope, nope. And then Donald Rumsfeld got appointed, and suddenly it's in your Diet Coke. So it's like now.
And I Googled that to check. Yeah, he's right.
Well, the FDA's credibility has been destroyed for me. And it's like those little things can diffuse. And this unapologetic Christian fella, he throws those things in for people, which I think is fabulous.
It's not called...
Up! Someone else hijacking my video. In this conversation that I just had too, Dan asked me about Miracles and why I read it. And I told him why I read it, because I could feel my Christian faith eroding, and I knew I needed to do something about it. And I decided that reading C.S. Lewis's book Miracles was really helpful for me. We all have to filter out the BS. We do have to do it. And this conversation between Charles Stang and John Vervaeke that just dropped yesterday, the whole conversation is tremendous. And it's a little hard to understand. I understand that. So you have someone from Harvard Divinity School talking with John, and you've got categories and names and all those kinds of things. But it's a great conversation. And they get into, again, what I call the Enlightenment scientific lab leak.
One be responsibly rational in this, where I don't mean rational to be logical. I mean, how does...
Now, a lot of the Vervaeke stuff is stuff that many of you heard, again, his understanding of rational, which is past new atheism.
How do we deal with the perennial problems of self-deception within human mm-hmm. observation, cognition, speculation, mm-hmm. etc.? We can to some degree avail ourselves of some of the techniques from science for overcoming self-deception. We can to some degree avail ourselves with some of the imaginal and transformative practices that take us out of the distortions of egocentrism or a flat ontology. But I want to give the question to you. I'll open it up to you. What are your thoughts about what does it mean to be, let's say, almost Socratically or Platonically rational? As we attempt to do this, you know, steering or reciprocal reconstruction. Does the question make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Well, it makes sense to me, and in the answer I'll give will tell you whether I heard it right.
Okay.
But so I think a lot about this in the context of longstanding communities of practice that afford or elicit extraordinary experiences. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking here, this is no doubt partly due to my training and background in the monasticism, Christian monasticism. Mm-hmm. Although I would invite you, because I know you work in work and practice in some Eastern traditions, to complement this. Mm-hmm. But there are
there's all these little tells. So he teaches at Harvard Divinity School. And that little tell, what happened is that pluralism. So earlier in this, maybe I should just play that other clip because I just found it tremendous. I put them both on Vanderclips.
often that these really important critical conversations in the humanities come at the cost of acknowledging the fuller and I would, you know, hazard to say sort of transcendent understanding of the human, mm-hmm. that the human has capacities that exceed our expectation. And so these sorts of altered states to me are signs of that transcendent humanity breaking through into our flatland.
Mm.
Now, the study of religion, I feel, is a, you know, the study of religion is a newcomer.
Now you can easily listen to this conversation on 1.5 or 2. He's a Charles Marshall Stang. He's a very slow talker. And I know a lot of you listen to me on this, so I usually don't speed up the videos that I'm watching on this. But yeah, if you're speeding me up, you still won't have any trouble with him.
Onto the field of the humanities in universities. Obviously, theology isn't, but the study of religion is very new.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it suffers from something of an inferiority complex. It's trying to fit in with the humanities. Uh-huh. And in order to fit in...
Now, this was an astounding statement that he made because it showed me how what happened... So if you read George Marston and his history of the universities and basically the secularizing of the universities and the de-Christianing of the universities, which is this is where the Christian national conversation should be taking place. You know, reading George Marston and understanding how the main line morphed in, and it's basically being able to see the church beneath secularism or the secular church and why all of that stuff happened. So basically that happens in the universities. The universities all had theological schools, and all of the theological schools morphed into these academic studies of religion schools. And these are all in crisis now, as modernity is in crisis now.
It's sort of trying to mimic the other, but the study of religion is very new.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it suffers from something of an inferiority complex. It's trying to fit in with the humanities.
Uh-huh.
And in order to fit in, it's sort of trying to mimic the other humanities. And I think this has come at a great cost. I think the humanities in general have been accomplices in their own obsolescence.
Just let that sink in. The humanities in general have been accomplices in their own obsolescence.
We all know the humanities are kind of in a decline. And I think that the study of religion is a kind of case study in that. Because for me, if there's anything that we can meaningfully constellate under that category of religion, which is, you know, a contested Western category under which we group all kinds of things. But if it has any meaning to me, it's a very expanded anthropology, ontology, and epistemology. This is an expansive understanding of what the human is, what are the world or worlds in which we are.
He's basically deconstructing the containment unit that religion got put in. And I think this is a key element of the dynamic that happened around the Jordan Peterson biblical series.
In which we are living, and how can we know those worlds, engage those worlds.
And this is a deep project of this little corner of the internet and the whole project of if I say re-enchanting, a bunch of you jump on me and say, the world is still enchanted, we're just not seeing it. And you're exactly right, of basically taking the blinkers off our eyes to the world as it is. No. Back to this one.
Monastic practice has, from its very beginning...
November is a month Catholics think about and pray for the dead.
Some of the techniques of science for overcoming self-deception, we can to some degree avail ourselves with some of the imaginal and transformative practices that take us out of the distortions of egocentrism or a flat ontology. But I want to give the question to you. I'll open it up to you. What are your thoughts about what does it mean to be, let's say, almost Socratically or Platonically rational? As we attempt to do this, you know, steering or reciprocal reconstruction. Does the question make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Well, it makes sense to me, and in the answer I'll give will tell you whether I heard it right.
Okay.
But so I think a lot about this in the context of longstanding communities of practice that afford or elicit extraordinary experiences. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking here, this is no doubt partly due to my training and background in the monasticism, Christian monasticism. Mm-hmm. Although I would invite you, because I know you work in practice in some Eastern traditions to complement this. Mm-hmm. But there are in monastic practice, as from its very beginnings in Egypt in the 4th century, occasioned in these men and women, these monks and nuns, extraordinary experiences. Mm-hmm. Extraordinary experiences of the angelic, the demonic, the divine, and the more than human. Mm-hmm. Visions, dreams, precognition, all variety of things. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what he's going to talk about is a filter that basically what all of these religious traditions have done, and including non-Christian religions, are to develop filters about this to get rid of what the self-deception, and really not just the self-deception, but the communal deception and the communal BS that John Vervaeke has been focusing on, to work through this. And this is a point that I made all the way back to whenever I engaged with Brett Weinstein and his material, because he would always say, well, this other, he always almost made it sound like people in the ancient world were dupes. And it's like, no. And you want proof of that? Read the Gospel of John and Thomas, who says, hey, look, I'm not going to believe he's risen until I put my finger in his hand and my hand in his side. People in the ancient world weren't dupes. And in fact, with all of the experience of what today we would call supernatural, they, of course, had different frameworks within which they understood this. They had all sorts of ways of thinking about that productively and filtering through it. And now, again, back to the communal element, filtering through it communally. And this is, again, we're taking sort of John's relevance realization and taking it one level up in terms of consciousness and practice. And this whole video with Vervaeke and Stang is absolutely tremendous. Just listen to it at 1.5 speed. It's absolutely tremendous, and they go into ritual and the role of ritual and all this. It's a tremendous conversation. But the point that he makes here is that all of these traditions had filters, and they used them.
None of those experiences are simply taken literally and granted
physically. This word literal, we really have to get rid of.
Truth, without being over generations sifted and scoured, almost. There is, in these communities, a sense that coarse self-delusion is not only possible, but is a persistent threat. And in fact, the delusion might not be even just coming from the self. There might be other forces that are trying to delude you. So obviously, in a Christian framework, that's going to be somewhat Satan and his minions, the demons. But I think the point I want to pull out of it, and it's a point actually beautifully made by Michael Murphy in The Future of the Body too, is that these are communities that actually have developed practices and protocols for sifting through experiences. And I know that such things exist in Buddhist communities as well, where there are also extraordinary visions and experiences.
And this is, of course, because all communities have to live in the world, and the world has all of these layers and elements to it.
Experiences had, but there is also a cultivation of, not so much, I don't want to say a distrust, but a critical distance on one's own experiences and the experiences of others. I think that kind of critical distance and that kind of sifting warrants the name rational. In a way, there's a kind of rationality in that that I think we would do well to recover, or at least we would do well to resource and retrieve and maybe reimagine for the communities that we're in now, which, as you said, are different than, you know, we're not in these we're not in a position where these traditions are quite so cleanly defined one from another. These spiritual but not religious folks kind of move in and out of each in and out of communities. So how can we adapt that kind of rationale discernment to a new context?
Now what he's really wrestling with is pluralism, and pluralism and globalization plays a huge role in the development, and you can see in, okay, now he's used to dealing with Harvard, and so that's a that's a community that's that has embraced pluralism. And so that's why he has to give all these little qualifiers. And that habit of giving the qualifiers, this also gets into the gentle slope, steep slope, neutral world conversation that that I think is an important one.
Excellent, excellent, which I think is part of the challenge of responding to the meaning crisis, what you just said. I want to, first of all, I think it would be buttressing your point about the rationality that we have the power of a collective intelligence of distributed cognition, both synchronically within a community and then diachronically across generations. It's very powerful, and it's doing this sifting very much so. And then I would put to you that that sifting is not, it may not look like rationality to us because of propositional tyranny, because we have reduced knowing to propositional tyranny. We've lost the procedural knowing. We've lost the perspectival. We've lost the participatory dimensions of rationality, which probably are, in fact, I would argue, as important and in some cases more important than propositional inferential.
Now this gets into the sedimentary aspect of what Senior Saboya was mentioning with his mom. Let's read this again. What you said about the Jews reading Torah via legal path and normies reading the Bible via cultural hodgepodge rings true for me. I was just talking with my mother over the holidays about her connection to the church, the faith, and the Bible. Naturally, I've heard some of what she said my whole life, but it never struck me how the structure of her faith is almost sedimentary. Now, I'm not saying that isn't true of the Jewish community as well. It certainly is, but there are, I mean, this kind of thing is so enormously nuanced and complex. There are themes and traditions, and the different sedimentary traditions matter as the communities are differentiated with respect to how they play themselves out. Layer after layer of affirming deposits have been laid over her lifetime. Having never made a concerted study of these matters, she seems to have developed and maintained a set of ideas over her life that has somehow opened spiritual doors for her. It's idiosyncratic and very personal, but it's also very collective and also very communal. And it has proven to work for her.
Rationality. And so therefore, both we should acknowledge what you've said, that this collective intelligence within distributed cognition greatly expanded, like I said, and that it's also dealing with dimensions of rationality that escape our kind of flatland understanding of rationality right now. So we have to both acknowledge the depth and the breadth of it, but also the fact that it is opening up domains and dimensions of rationality that we are kind of blind to right now. So I first want to put that out and see how that...
Now this again is part of the conversation about John's continual recalibration of how we're using this word rationality, much against a certain YouTube channel that uses that word, and I don't think it means what you think it means.
That lands with you as a problem. Yeah.
Earlier when I was complaining about a sort of a diminished anthropology, ontology, and epistemology that to me is sort of afflicting the study of religion and the other humanities, if I would just focus on that last one, a kind of diminished epistemology, what you've just said lands very poignantly for me, which is I feel as if, as you've said, there's a kind of propositional tyranny that has flattened rationality.
Yes.
And under the banner of an expanded epistemology, how we know, I would want to include these efforts to expand rationality. What are the modes of reasoning that we might not, as you said, recognize anymore as reasoning?
Yes.
But are deeply deep forms of reasoning.
Yes.
What do they look? I mean, can we recover these and redeploy them?
And this is what happens with Senior Saboya's mom. Is that this is the rationality that's happening? Whereas she's maybe not intentionally digging in and reshaping the sediment, she is engaging with it, but that's happening as a community. And that's shaping her, just like the men are deciding which men will be at the top of the mating status hierarchy.
Meaningfully today.
Yeah. I think of that as a sapiential notion of rationality.
Yes.
And therefore, it ties to the earlier claim that therefore there are ways of disclosing the world, and in that sense, knowing, that require transformation and transcendence. We have lost... let me call it a contemplative axis of ratio, and we reduced it to the computational, and then it has been further reduced, as you said, within the humanities to a kind of communicative thing. And so we've got this reduction. Now, for me, when you sort of, I mean, I would propose you're going to start moving towards something like a virtue epistemology, because virtues combine propositional beliefs with procedural skills, with, you know, with perspectival, you know, states of consciousness, states of mind.
And it's going to be communities of virtue. It's going to be communities that reinforce, discipline, enforce, encourage, promote.
With participatory character traits, and that we understand that. And the fact that virtue epistemology and virtue ethics are taking off right now, I don't think is a coincidence either. I think it's an attempt to try and get back to, can we broaden our responsiveness to normativity to include beyond our propositional commitment to sort of logical coherence and empirical adequacy? So I think that's an important thing to note. And then I want to now bring it back to engaging with it, because for me, like the thing that, well, like when I'm reading Plotinus, I aspire to being like Plotinus as a writer and a thinker, just like I aspire to being like Socrates as a person. Those are my two big aspirations.
Okay, now I know for some of you, Verveke is hard to follow. We're just transitioning now into the transformational, which is sort of the secular word to talk about conversion, to talk about life change that happens deep and wells up and transforms. Now, even as in some ways the collective biblical relevance realization is a slow process of, let's say, sedimentary development, these moments of transformation can be quick. And a lot of the shift happens sort of when the collective biblical relevance realization really moves suddenly and something is introduced into it. And these things can come on us. Let me grab it. So Bethel McGrew had an appearance on the Beckett Cook show. I didn't know who Beckett Cook was. He showed up on the Abide channel. That's within the sphere of our own little culture war in the Christian Reformed Church. But so then I started reading his memoir. So I started reading Beckett's book on his conversion, and wow.
Chapter 2, Deus Ex Machina, Conversion. It was as though a light of confidence flooded into my heart and all the darkness of doubt was dispelled. Augustine, Confessions. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my Father's God, and I will exalt him. Exodus 15:2. The moment of truth. On September 20th, 2009, that peculiar day I found myself in an evangelical church for the first time, I sat in the auditorium, listening intently as the pastor began his sermon from the Apostle Paul's letter to the Romans. I, along with the rest of the congregation, was captivated. As he preached, every sentence that came out of his mouth resonated as truthful to me. It was strange, and I had no idea why. My thoughts kept exclaiming, "Yes, that's true! Yes, that's true! Yes, that's true!" My mind and heart were agreeing with every word he was saying, and continued to do so for the entire hour-long sermon. At one point, I remember thinking, "This is the gospel?" What he was saying was turning everything I thought I knew about religion on its head. I was stunned by the utter simplicity of it. He opened the sermon by saying, "Most people think Christianity or the Christian life means being a good person and not sinning." Yep, that's what I always thought. As he continued, I began to realize that I had never really understood the true gospel. For the first time, I learned that a loving creator designed us to exist in relationship with him, with each other, and with the rest of creation. Our creator is a holy, good, and loving God. But we, humanity, turned away from him because of pride. We sought to establish our own autonomy, our own independence, and attempted to become our own God, rather than trust in and depend on him. And when this happened, the very fabric of our being went awry. This is the origin of our downfall. Having rejected the very source of our being, our hearts became twisted, self-centered, disoriented, and corrupted. All of us are born into this. We spend much of our lives pursuing our own self-interests at the expense of so many around us. Instead of living to serve others and helping them flourish, we seek our own agendas to others' destruction as well as our own. We violate the very creatures God loves so deeply. And in the process, we all remain in enmity with our holy and good Creator. I had seriously misunderstood the Christian religion to be all about man trying to morally perform in his strength to be approved by and made acceptable to God. So he spends his life just trying to be a good person, thinking maybe if he lives a good enough life, he will one day be accepted by God. But now it became clear to me that no one could ever perform well enough to measure up. the overwhelming wonder of God's infinite love is this. While I was broken and a failure, God came to rescue me. He came to love me, to redeem me, and to heal me from sin. Where I failed, Christ succeeded on my behalf. Where I distrusted, Christ was faithful. Where I proudly resisted, he humbly surrendered. Through his obedience, he bridged the chasm between my darkness and his light. On the cross, God's Son took my place and became a sacrifice for all my failures. In his resurrection, he triumphed over all my destruction. And he now stands as my victorious Redeemer, offering me and all who will simply receive him his forgiveness and vindication. Christ clothes my shame and brokenness with his righteous and holy life. I heard the Christian message loud and clear that day. I, in and of myself, had nothing to give or do. I had only to receive. This is the good news. Grasping this for the first time had me feeling that it was almost too good to be true. No way, this is the gospel? My heart was racing. I would never have believed that I could be this enthralled by a sermon. The hour flew by and I didn't want it to end. After the sermon, the pastor closed his eyes and prayed. Before walking off stage, he invited anyone who wanted prayer for anything to come up to the front of the stage from either side of the auditorium, where people were waiting to pray for them. As the worship band began playing, everyone in the congregation stood and began singing again, songs that were foreign to me. I had just been moved more than I had ever been before, but I was still uncomfortable in this unfamiliar environment. I stood up along with the rest of the congregation to avoid drawing attention to myself. I considered going over to the side of the auditorium and asking for prayer, but doing so would mean admitting to myself that this all could be real. And I wasn't sure I was ready for the impact such admission would have on my life. For some reason, a thought came to me that Colin, who had invited me to church, was probably watching every move I made. So I just stood there, frozen, simply too embarrassed to move. As the music continued, I kept feeling the pull to ask for prayer. I would take one step forward, but then immediately step back. This went on for several minutes. I must have looked ridiculous as I wrestled internally with myself. Finally, I just thought, you know what? I'm here. I might as well do this. So I walked down the aisle to the right side of the auditorium and went to the nearest person I could find on the prayer team. I said, "Hi, I'm not a Christian, and I don't know what I believe, but I'm here." He responded immediately, "Okay, let me pray for you." He laid his hands on my shoulders and uttered a long and powerful prayer. I don't remember exactly what he prayed, but I remember thinking, why does this stranger care about me so much? There was such a sense of love in his words and tone that I was deeply moved by it. After he finished, I thanked him and made my way back to my seat. The congregation was still standing and singing, then they began lining up to take communion. But reeling from all the stimuli and feeling unsteady on my feet, I sat down to let my mind process it all.
Okay, so classic story of Christian conversion. This gay man in a mega church who, you know, suddenly turns his life 180 degrees around, and, you know, he's raised Roman Catholic and now he's in a mega church. But this, I mean, this transformation is what we're talking about here. And now in his case, he had all these sedimentary layers, but then a transformation comes and it just sort of changes it. And how he describes it is a complete change of perspective, even though he had gone to Catholic high school and all of this stuff. Now suddenly, whoosh, transformation occurs and his life is completely different. And his life is completely different in terms of what he does now compared to what he did before.
Divine doubles. We could perhaps come back to that in a minute, because I do want to make a connection between rationality and aspiration and then get into the divine double. But before I...
So aspiration... For him, suddenly there's a new vision of who he is and what he is.
I could say that, like, when I'm reading Plotinus, it took me a while to realize this, and then I was able to do the same thing with Spinoza, who seems like the most computational of all philosophers, but in fact he's not. He's ultimately talking about love, which is and participation in God. And I think Claire Carlisle's book on Spinoza's religion is a masterpiece about that, just fantastic book. But when I'm reading Plotinus, it's like I'm simultaneously getting an argument in the traditional sort of premises leading to a conclusion, and I'm going through an imaginal spiritual exercise at the same time. Like, and the text doesn't feel cacophonous or disjointed. And then I'm thinking that I want to be, able to take the stance that affords me having that kind of rationality. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, right. And so that to me it is. Something exemplary. And I think the whole Neoplatonic tradition, I mean, of course, there's variations in it, but there's very often that concerted effort to make something simultaneously an argument and a spiritual exercise. I think Proclus's Elements of Theology is doing the same thing.
Absolutely.
In a deep way. And then part of what I'm saying is that we have often, and this is a way of extending Pierre Hadot, we've often misread these ancient texts, and especially Plato, because what we do is we lift the argument out out of all of this.
Okay, so now notice, this isn't just hermeneutics. This is, what he's saying is that our entire culture has misread the text. And this was, of course, Pierre Hadot's great insight. And you'll hear Pierre Hadot's name dropped by John Vervaeke. You'll hear it dropped by Bishop Barron. Pierre Hadot begins to realize that, wait a minute, there's a lot more stuff going on in this ancient world. We just don't have eyes to see and ears to hear.
Spiritual exercise. Now, thankfully, third wave Platonism is now correcting that. You know, the work of Gonzalez and Hyland and Kirkland and Ruchik and all of those people that I'm doing a lot of work with, like I'm making use of their work. But it's like, I'm trying to say that there's kind of this recursive insidious thing that the flatland thing actually prevents us, it makes us misread the texts that might exemplify for us.
And it's beautiful that flatland is a sedimentary area.
The kind of rationality we need to get out of the flatland. I know that was a long argument, but
I get it.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Let's not play something else now. So what you can see is that it takes, in some ways, a change of landscape to recognize. And there are conversion moments of transformation where suddenly, and it's really a dramatic story, it's just the beginning of the book. The rest of the book, he unfolds the story a little bit more. But it's just this massive transformation. And it's a huge transformation, and it's surprising. But there's also sort of these sedimentary levels that come. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit more about why it's probably good that Jordan didn't have a biblical scholar in the team. And part of that is because, for example, I was trained as a seminarian in the grammatical historical process of interpretation. Now, what does that mean? Grammatical historical is basically modernist, because you had to, in modernity, This was the attempt to sort of try to keep the church from falling, from getting taken away. And of course, Gresham Machen, Christianity and Liberalism. I mean, that's a story of that whole process of fundamentalism and eventually evangelicalism, and the attempt to not yield completely to modernity. And so the sort of justification that they would have in terms of the Bible was to either look to the grammar of the text, which could not be denied because there it is. Well, there's grammar in the text, and you can look at that level of meaning, or to relate the Bible to history, okay? To this, the type of modernist history that we as a culture had faith in. And so when Cosmic Skeptic comes in and says, well, we should probably pull it up.
An atheist. So, does Peterson think that the events of the Bible are fictional, or does he think that they really happened?
Okay, right there you get 200 years of modernist biblical scholarship, because that then is the obsession, because in the interest of the fundamentalists and the evangelicals, if you can show that the events of the Bible really happened, but nowhere does anyone pause to say, what do we mean by really happened? Now, for me to ask the question, suddenly a whole bunch of New Ageists would come and say, you're an obscurantist. You're trying to obscure the plain meaning of what really happened. And you can get the same assault from fundamentalists or evangelicals if you play this in a different way. But the whole point is concordism. And I've used that word before, and some people have asked, well, what do you mean by that? Well, is there concordance? And this very much lines up with John Vervaeke's, the rationality that John Vervaeke is deconstructing and showing to be skeptical, because postmodernity basically undercut this already and said, there is no monarchical vision from which you can sort of see the world as it is. And so then say, did these things actually happen or really happen or any way that you want to say them? Now, many people for a very long time, in fact, this conversation goes back a long ways, because just as Charles Stang noted, throughout history, people have understood that there's lying and dupes and disinformation and all sorts of things. And so, yes, when Doubting Thomas comes in and says, y'all say he resurrected, but unless I see the nail prints and touch his side, I ain't buying it. And there was one, I can't pull up the comment right now, but there was one person who basically said, again, in one of my comments, he says, yeah, no, resurrection, dead people stay dead. Maybe I saved that. Maybe it was on Twitter. I don't have time to find it. But basically, everybody knows dead people stay dead. Oh, okay. Well, so did Thomas. He knew that too. And so to have this conversation doesn't undermine, you know, I mentioned here event character, which is the language used in the Christian Reformed Church Report 44 in the mid-1970s, that, you know, the Bible does not retell history in a modernist way. And this is where, obviously, the new sedimentary layer, which is an old sedimentary layer, which Jonathan Peugeot is picking up and putting down again. You know, there's too many metaphors and images here. Sort of the recession of modernity exposes lots of other old sedimentary layers. It's maybe an uplift, and we say, oh, look at all the stripes. Look at all the stripes on that hillside. Why are there all these levels? Well, this is what's going on. Because biblical, the focus of a lot of biblical scholarship has been, well, what does the text say, and what does the archaeology say? But what cosmic skeptic doesn't understand is that basically these waves coming through culture have come through. And when I was in seminary, which was in the 1980s, already it was seen that the literary approach to the Bible was far more productive in terms of helping people connect their worlds than, let's say, a lot of dry, old, grammatical, historical. And so that's when Robert Alter, and we understand sort of storytelling and how stories are told and the implications of what that means for the Bible. This has been going on for a very long time. And so, I mean, this, I liked how Grim Grizz said it. When I talk that way, people say I'm pedantic. I don't quite know what that word means, but... Well, yeah, that's very much what we're talking about here, and of course Lewis points this out in Miracles again and again and again, in that language doesn't work. The way that this sort of simplistic, pedantic rationalism imagines it does. Now that doesn't mean one way or the other that suddenly whoosh we're all fundamentalists, or whoosh we're all mythicists that say, well, it doesn't really matter if anything happened in the Bible or not, because I just live into the story. No, that the Bible doesn't actually let you get away with that either, because some of the really pedantic straw-manning that cosmic skeptic does here is because if I would ask him, oh, I don't know, there are Romans in the Bible, or you say that Romans didn't occupy the Galilean Judea? No, that part of the Bible is historical. Okay, well, what about Hezekiah as well? Well, that part of the Bible is historical. Okay, well, what about Solomon? Well, Solomon was, well, you know, very quickly he's going to have to recognize that there's a great deal of archaeological evidence for an enormous amount that's in the Bible, and that the biblical authors intended to relay what they experienced in the manifest image in a particular way to shape life and religion. That's the purpose of the book. And you know, if you go all the way back to the beginning of John Vervaeke's Awakening from the Meaning Crisis, he touches on sort of the Hebraic revolution of history. And how, in many ways, this has so completely formed us. But now, again, we're in the middle of one of these major transitions where we come to the Bible and we have to say, okay, well, what does this mean? How can I understand it? And in that way, really, Jordan Peterson comes on the scene, and there's really a new Concordism, because he brings... You know, whereas Darwin, for many, was the enemy, now certainly Peterson, he's a Darwinist. And he's looking at psychology, and he's, in a sense, we've had another uplift, and all sorts of these sedimentary layers are available, and Jordan's kind of looking at the symbolic layers and all of these other layers and saying, well, you know, we've been relating history in some different ways.
Is that the ancient language of the church that was developed organically and universally for 1,200, 1,300 years, slowly started to slip away from people's memory. And so an image...
Now, what blew my mind in Jonathan Peugeot's Introduction to Christian Iconography is the realization that what all of this art was again, a language. And that they didn't have, you know, there wasn't a central church administration that was going out and saying, okay, well, you know, we got all these bare walls in the church and we should probably do something with it. Well, maybe we can take stuff from the Bible and put it up there. And no, that's a very modernist approach to this. That is not at all what happened.
For example, that everybody knows, which is, you know, the Michelangelo's creation of God, of Adam, you know, with the two fingers showing, is an absolute anomaly in the history of Christian art. It's a complete freak thing that shows up.
And it's a really bad idea, because what it did was influence all sorts of people, like Cosmic Skeptic, that says, well, Christianity imagines that there's a dude that looks like Paul Vanderclay floating in the sky. No.
And although we tend to think of it as some kind of model of an image, a religious image of showing God creating Adam, it's actually a complete aberration, which actually never even gave fruit in the church.
Sorry that the volume is too low. It's just, I can't do much about it.
So there are no other versions of that image. Whereas a traditional language is more like a poetic form. As it installs itself, it creates these patterns. And then these patterns, like a folk dance, for example, is a good way to understand it. There are patterns of movement that get taken up by people and that we can recognize in different folk dances, although there's some difference, there's a common language of coming together, of ways to move, and that is the manner in which we have to understand traditional languages of art. They are participative. They're there to bring you into the community, bring you into a common.
Okay, at the end there, he's talking about the purpose of it, but I want to focus on the development of it, because, again, they didn't all sit down and say, well, this is the way we're going to draw it. They're watching each other. It's almost probably pre-linguistic in their minds. It's imagistic, and they are having a conversation with each other in what they're putting on the churches. And again, there's no, well, here's the guide. The guide that Peugeot gives as he walks through images here in the talk is the after element of it in the work. That's us coming back and saying, recognizing the patterns and saying, oh, and so in that way, it's more like the science, but it's the change has happened. The language has been developed. The patterns are going on. Now, what we see with the biblical lectures are this development in action. And in some ways, the Jordan Peterson biblical series were like an earthquake. And suddenly there's a rupture. And, you know, in similar, some of my early conversations with Ron Dart, you know, I said in some ways, Peterson's like a Luther. And that, well, there's all this stuff pent up, and you can read the pre-Reformation history. You can look at Wycliffe. Wycliffe had elements of it, but in many ways he was a devoted churchman in the Catholic Church. Huss was an early eruption, but that one got suppressed, and by virtue of the political nature of where Luther was and his prince and all of this, he couldn't get suppressed, and it exploded. Well, Jordan Peterson wasn't as large an explosion as Luther by any means, but it was analogous in that, well, suddenly there was sort of a new breakout in collective biblical relevance realization. And that's what happened in the first biblical series. He added a powerful new sedimentary layer that made the Bible plausible in a way that it never seemed to be before. Now, maybe I just made this slide a couple hours ago. Maybe instead it was sort of an uplift that we had, that suddenly a lot of what he does in the biblical series is not only sort of add another layer, but go through some of the old layers and say, look at this, look at this, look at this. And of course, just like when you have an uplift, new layers come onto the exposed surface, and transformations have come from this. Now, the second seminar, this is, we should probably call this the biblical seminar, because that's really the more the form it is. And as I said before, this is a precursor. He's going to he's going to do a solo act too after this. But what he's doing is sort of getting his act together in terms of what he wants to say. He is getting informed, and he is doing in some ways like this little corner of the internet is doing it. He is doing it collectively, and he is trying to sort of bring together other layers. Now, some of you, rightly or wrongly, might say, well, there's some layers missing. Yeah, but the truth is he can't do all the layers, and he can't do it himself. And so he, and it's absolutely his right to, has decided who he wants around the table to try to work through these layers and get it right. As I read on my Substack, and again, I think so often with me, it's not until I write it or it's not until I speak it that I sort of know it. Jordan Peterson has managed to better inform his biblical reading without blunting his own fresh observations. The goal isn't to contribute to modernist biblical scholarship, but to refresh the practice of lay Bible study. In other words, He's participating in the sedimentary process of collective biblical relevance realization. That's really what's going on. It has the sort of wild and diverse qualities that the best Bible studies have to offer. Here, with an interesting cast of diverse perspectives contributing, connecting regular people to hear the Bible speak to them in their own context. And again, he's adjusting the sedimentary. See, now at the end of the video, I'm going to have the title. It's going to be a weird one, but it's going to be Sedimentary Collective Biblical Relevance Realization. That's really what we're talking about. And that's why maybe I should have the why question be the title of the video. That's why the biblical series is so impactful. Let me know what you think. Am I right? Am I wrong? Am I all wet? Do you want to say something snarky and nasty about me? That's what the comments are for.